262, Part 3, Chapter 3 of Gulliver's Travels.
Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 262, Brain Drain. This week's episode is brought to you by Knit Circus, the e-newsletter that can arrive in your mailbox delivering three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can sign up at www.knitcircus.com. And SeedPod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative. We publish books, not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? And Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. Well, hello! I am going to hop to it today because I am getting ready to go to the beach without a work deadline on me. It's going to be the first time that I've been able to do this since 2003. Actually, since 2002. That was the last time I was able to actually go somewhere and not have to take a laptop and work pretty much all the time. I'm thrilled about this. I'm also kind of freaked out, but, you know, my work never really ends, so I'm just kind of picking an arbitrary point and saying, basta, I've done all I can do. I will still be reading and knitting and designing and all of that good stuff, but that's about it, which means I'm getting out two podcasts today, one for today and one for next Friday when I will still be at the beach. So, without any further wasting of the time, let's get to Gulliver. Well, it turns out, in my humble opinion, that this is one of the most interesting chapters in Gulliver's Travels, and it's not interesting just for its satire, which is evident and purposeful, but because this is such an awesome piece of science fiction. Even Isaac Asimov, who I fully expected to just kind of rip into Jonathan Swift during this particular part three, he has some really interesting respect for what Swift pulls off in this particular chapter. Now, he is Swift, is making fun of scientists of his day still. And we know that that's something he enjoys doing. But he's doing a couple of other things too, and one of them will blow your socks off. Now, I'm fairly certain that in the past I have talked about the fog index. That is the way that we can calculate how complex a piece of writing is. And part of complexity, of understanding how complex a piece of writing is understanding whether that obscures the meaning. You know, if you're obfuscating the obvious, you are not writing well, no matter how many big words you're using. And in fact, using big words may not be the best way to go in a given piece of writing. And I remember reading somewhere, and I think I've mentioned this back when we were doing Flatland, I remember reading somewhere that Isaac Asimov was starting to get irked with Scientific American, and that their level of obfuscation of the obvious was rising dramatically. And so he wrote some very simple, straightforward, scientifically correct and accurate, and rather eruditely written text to Scientific American, and he put somebody else's name on it, you know, Joe Schmo, and got a letter back saying, you know, I'm sorry, this doesn't really rise to the level of our writing, blah, blah, blah. And he sent it back to them with his own name on it saying, you dopes, you know, don't publish stuff that sounds impressive, publish stuff that is impressive. You want people to be able to understand science. And, you know, our world today is kind of showing us what happens when you don't have good science education, especially when so much of the world around us relies on scientific advancement. You know, it's not important that we understand how Velcro is made, but it is important that we understand what it does. Just like it doesn't matter so much if you understand how petrochemicals burn, what matters is that you know not to suck on a tailpipe. It's all kind of the same thing. Well, Swift, in this section, starts off making something really quite simple and actually kind of plausible sound really complicated. And he actually gets into a point where it does start to sound like Flatland, where it's like, imagine a line with A and point B. And, you know, he goes on like that. It doesn't matter. None of that stuff matters. What matters is the general concept, which you will get. And it's kind of a cool idea. Now, it isn't actually physiologically possible for his idea to work. And it all comes down to magnetism. And at the end, we'll talk about why it won't work. But it's a cool idea. And he spends so much time. I mean, he was really thinking about this and figuring it out. This guy, he's a smarty pants, this guy. Now, one of the words that he's going to use over and over again is the word adamant. And for those of you who like X-Men, you know that this word gets used in the mythology of Wolverine. Well, let me fill you in a little bit on the history of the word adamant, because it is an interesting word in and of itself. It has been used, the word, as an imaginary stone of impenetrable hardness and strength. It has also been used as a word for the hardest substance that actually exists. In fact, diamond is the hardest substance, but it can shatter easily. And so when somebody's talking about something being adamantine or some rock being adamant, it is hard, will not shatter. The third possible meaning is more complicated. Adamant is from the Greek word meaning, or Greek words, it's a compound, meaning untamable, okay, which is kind of cool. However, in Latin, adamare is a word that means to love. Magnetism was thought to be a phenomenon analogous to love, because magnets attract iron. So adamant could be used as another word for a magnet. And so in some places, adamant is used instead of, old places, you know, archaically, is used as a word for magnet. That is kind of cool. So all of those things come to bear. And it's Swift had all of those definitions in his head when he was writing, I think. Because, like I said, this is science fiction. So he actually found a word that had many, many layers of meaning in it that he was able to use as though it were scientifically specific. Now, for those of you on a scientific bent, you will notice that Swift does something really interesting. And for those of you who read Discworld books, you will notice something very interesting. If you've seen or read The Color of Magic, the movie version is very funny, or if you've seen Hogfather, they do a beautiful job, I think, a beautiful job physically representing the insane Discworld that Terry Pratchett invented in his Discworld novels. This place, Laputa, is not all that different from Discworld. It's not on the back of an elephant, on the back of a turtle, or anything like that, but it is, for all intents and purposes, a disc, and it is flying. Now, one of the things that makes Discworld so interesting is it has oceans, and they go up to the edge of the world and fall off and make beautiful waterfalls. Well, Laputa, in Swift's imagining, is a closed system. It's its own little ecosystem. And it's really interesting, I think, that he thought of it this way. Because, of course, it's going to get the same kinds of clouds that the people on the ground get. It's going to get the same rain and stuff like that. But no, he's got it more specific than that. And it's just really cool. He will mention an astronomer's cave. This was evidently a cave at the Royal Observatory in Paris. I don't know if that's true or not, but Isaac Asimov says it is. He'll talk about lodestones. Lodestones are magnets. They're just naturally occurring ones, so they're not a piece of steel that's been treated to create a magnet, which is kind of cool. and he's going to throw sizes out at you again. And I always find that it's easier for me to visualize this stuff when I've got his dimensions down. So to give you a comparison, Laputa is about 7/10 the island of Manhattan. So it's pretty big, but not humongous. And Balnibari, which you will hear about later in this chapter, is about 3/4 the size of Rhode Island. So the king in Laputa can float around over Balnibari, and that would be flying almost the island of Manhattan over almost the state of Rhode Island. So not bad. It's pretty good. Now, as usual, the political satire doesn't kick in until the end of the chapter, but when you hear about the rising and lowering of Laputa and the reasons why they might raise or lower, just keep in mind, Laputa, English government, Balnibari, the island on the ground, Ireland. And we'll get into more of that after you've listened to the chapter, because it's not going to matter. You're going to understand it all just fine. A nice little Isaac Asimov note is you will hear perhaps the first description of aerial bombardment in literature in this chapter. So I turn you over to Aaron Ziegler reading the marvelously visionary chapter of Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift.
Chapter 3, a phenomenon solved by modern philosophy and astronomy, the Laputians' great improvements in the latter, the king's method of suppressing insurrections. I desired leave of this prince to see the curiosities of the island, which he was graciously pleased to grant, and ordered my tutor to attend me. I chiefly wanted to know what cause in art or in nature it owed its several motions, whereof I will now give a philosophical account to the reader. The flying or floating island is exactly circular, its diameter 7,837 yards, or about 4 miles and a half, and consequently contains 10 acres. It is 300 yards thick. The bottom, or undersurface, which appears to those who view it from below, is one even regular plate of adamant, shooting up to the height of about 200 yards. Above it lie the several minerals in their usual order, and over all is a coat of rich mold 10 or 12 foot deep. The declivity of the upper surface from the circumference to the center is the natural cause why all the dews and rains which fall upon the island are conveyed in small rivulets toward the middle, where they are emptied into 4 large basins, each of about 1/2 mile in circuit and 200 yards distant from the center. From these basins, the water is continually exhaled by the sun in the daytime, which effectively prevents their overflowing. Besides, as it is in the power of the monarch to raise the island above the region of clouds and vapors, he can prevent the falling of dews and rains whenever he pleases. For the highest clouds cannot rise above 2 miles, as naturalists agree. At least, they were never known to do so in that country. At the center of the island, there is a chasm, about 50 yards in diameter, from whence the astronomers descend into a large dome, which is therefore called Flendona Gagnole, or the Astronomer's Cave, situated at the depth of 100 yards beneath the upper surface of the adamant. In this cave are 20 lamps continually burning, which, from the reflection of the adamant, cast a strong light into every part. The place is stored with great variety of sextants, quadrants, telescopes, astrolabes, and other astronomical instruments. The greatest curiosity upon which the fate of the island depends is a lodestone of prodigious size, in the shape resembling a weaver's shuttle. It is in length 6 yards, and in the thickest part at least 3 yards over. This magnet is sustained by a very strong axle of adamant passing through its middle, upon which it plays and is poised so exactly that the weakest hand can turn it. It is hooped round with an hollow cylinder of adamant, 4 foot deep, as many thick, and 12 yards in diameter, placed horizontally, and supported by 8 adamantine feet, each 6 yards high. In the middle of the concave side, there is a groove 12 inches deep, in which the extremities of the axle are lodged, and turned round as there is occasion. This stone cannot be moved from its place by any force, because the hoop and its feet are one continued piece with that body of adamant which constitutes the bottom of the island. By means of this lodestone, the island is made to rise and fall and move from one place to another. For with respect to that part of the earth over which the monarch presides, the stone is endued at one of its sides with an attractive power, and at the other with a repulsive. Upon placing the magnet erect with its attracting end toward the earth, the island descends. But when the repelling extremity points downwards, the island mounts directly upwards. When the position of the stone is oblique, the motion of the island is too. For in this magnet, the forces always act in lines parallel to its direction. By this oblique motion, the island is conveyed to different parts of the monarch's dominions. To explain the manner of its progress, let AB represent a line drawn across the dominions of Balnibarbi. Let line CD represent the lodestone, of which let D be the repelling end and C the attracting end, the island being over C. Let the stone be placed in the position CD with its repelling end downwards. Then the island will be driven upwards obliquely towards D. When it is arrived at D, let the stone be turned upon its axle till its attracting end points towards E, and then the island will be carried obliquely towards E, where, if the stone be again turned upon its axle till it stands in the position EF with its repelling point downwards, the island will rise obliquely towards F, where by directing the attracting end towards G, the island may be carried to G and from G to H by turning the stone so as to make its repelling extremity point directly downwards. And thus, by changing the situation of the stone as often as there is occasion, the island is made to rise and fall by turns in an oblique direction, and by those alternate risings and fallings, the obliquity being not considerable, is conveyed from one part of the dominions to the other. But it must be observed that this island cannot move beyond the extent of the dominions below, nor can it rise above the height of 4 miles, for which the astronomers, who have written large systems concerning the stone, assign the following reason: that the magnetic virtue does not extend beyond the distance of 4 miles, and that the mineral which acts upon the stone in the bowels of the earth and in the sea, about 6 leagues distant from the shore, is not diffused through the whole globe, but terminated within the limits of the king's dominions. And it was easy, from the great advantage of such a superior situation, for a prince to bring under his obedience whatever country lay within the attraction of that magnet. When the stone is put parallel to the plane of the horizon, the island standeth still, for in that case, the extremities of it being at equal distance from the earth act with equal force, the one in drawing downwards, the other in pushing upwards, and consequently, no motion can ensue. This lodestone is under the care of certain astronomers who, from time to time, give it such positions as the monarch directs. They spend the greatest part of their lives in observing the celestial bodies, which they do by the assistance of glasses, far excelling ours in goodness. For although their largest telescopes do not exceed 3 feet, they magnify much more than those of 100 with us, and show the stars with greater clearness. This advantage hath enabled them to extend their discoveries much farther than our astronomers in Europe. They have made a catalogue of 10,000 fixed stars, whereas the largest of ours do not contain above 1/3 part of that number. They have likewise discovered 2 lesser stars, or satellites, which revolve about Mars, whereof the innermost is distant from the center of the primary planet exactly 3 of its diameters, and the outermost 5. The former revolves in space of 10 hours, and the latter in 21.5, so that the squares of their periodical times are very near in the same proportion with the cubes of their distance from the center of Mars, which evidently shows them to be governed by the same law of gravitation that influences the other heavenly bodies. They have observed 93 different comets and settled their periods with great exactness. If this be true, and they affirm it with great confidence, it is much to be wished that their observations were made public, whereby the theory of comets, which at present is very lame and defective, might be brought to the same perfection with other parts of astronomy. the king would be the most absolute prince in the universe if he could but prevail on a ministry to join with him. But these, having their estates below on the continent, and considering that the office of a favorite hath a very uncertain tenure, would never consent to the enslaving of their country. If any town should engage in rebellion or mutiny, fall into violent factions, or refuse to pay the usual tribute, the king hath two methods of reducing them to obedience. The first and the mildest course is by keeping the island hovering over such a town and the lands about it, whereby he can deprive them of the benefit of the sun and the rain, and consequently afflict the inhabitants with dearth and diseases. And if the crime deserve it, they are at the same time pelted from above with great stones, against which they have no defense but by creeping into cellars or caves while the roofs of their houses are beaten to pieces. But if they still continue obstinate or offer to raise insurrections, he proceeds to the last remedy, by letting the island drop directly upon their heads, which makes a universal destruction both of houses and men. However, this is an extremity to which the prince is seldom driven, neither indeed is he willing to put it in execution, nor dare his ministers advise him to an action which, as it would render them odious to the people, so it would be a great damage to their own estates that lie all below, for the island is the king's demesne. But there is still indeed a more weighty reason why the kings of this country have been always averse from executing so terrible an action unless upon the utmost necessity. For if the town intended to be destroyed should have in it any tall rocks, as it generally falls out in the larger cities, a situation probably chosen at first with view to prevent such a catastrophe, or if it abound in high spires or pillars of stone, a sudden fall might endanger the bottom or undersurface of the island, which, although it consists, as I have said, of one entire adamant 200 yards thick, might happen to crack by too great a shock, or burst by approaching too near the fires from the houses below, as the backs both of iron and stone will often do in our chimneys. Of all this, the people are well apprised, and understand how far to carry their obstinacy where their liberty or property is concerned. And the king, when he is highest provoked and most determined to press a city to rubbish, orders the island to descend with great gentleness, out of a pretense of tenderness to his people, but indeed for fear of breaking the adamantine bottom, in which case it is the opinion of all their philosophers that the lodestone could no longer hold it up, and the whole mass would fall to the ground.
Now, our chapter doesn't stop here in our edition. There is more, but it's such an interesting twist that I wanted to just go over a couple of things that we've listened to before playing you the part of the chapter that was suppressed for a really, really long time. So first, the really cool, awesome stuff. When Gulliver's Travels was written, nobody knew that Mars had two satellites. In fact, those two satellites weren't going to be officially discovered for 151 years. Now, it is quite impressive that Swift identified two Martian satellites, that he placed them quite close to Mars. The real satellites are actually even closer to Mars, so Swift's determination that they needed to be close was impressive. But he wasn't willing to put them as close as they actually are. Now, even his statement about how quickly they revolve around Mars is really shockingly close to real. However, Asimov points out that once you place the satellites close in, if you understand Kepler, then you can come up with a pretty good idea of how fast they're going to revolve around the planet. Now, some people have actually said, well, clearly Swift was a Martian, and that's why he knew about all of this stuff. And obviously, that's a joke. But it is really interesting because in 1610, Galileo discovered that Jupiter had four satellites. Now, obviously, there are more, but that's what he could see. And there were a lot of people who thought that Mars must have satellites as well. And of course, when I say satellites, I'm talking about moons. However, because the moons of Mars are so close to the body, the surface of Mars, it means that they're harder to see. You know, they're not hanging off in the distance, so you can't see them up against the blackness of space. They're pretty much going to be traveling across the face of Mars, and that's very hard to see with the kinds of telescopes that they had at the time. Swift is not wrong in decrying the telescopy that was available to him when he wrote. It wasn't until 31 years after the book was written that the advances in the making of telescopes became such that you could shorten the length of your telescope and improve your ability to see. It had a lot to do with parabolic lenses and all sorts of stuff, and Isaac Asimov spends a lot of time talking about this, and I just thought it was kind of interesting that he knows that better tools and equipment are both needed and close. You know, they're almost to that next discovery. That I thought was kind of funny in this section is that he does, in fact, have to cave in and use Newton's law of gravitation. And we know how much that must have burned him that Newton was right about anything. And he certainly doesn't give any credit to Newton on that account. I'm sure you heard the guys in Laputa had their estates on the continent below. So you've got England and English landlords holding Irish land and depriving them of the benefit of sun and rain. This could have been interference from the government on any one of a number of things, whether it was trade or anything else. You know, it's the outsiders, the people who live far away from you, trying to control your environment. Now, when he gets into the talk of tall rocks and high spires and pillars of stone, there's consensus that what he is talking about is the tall rock is Irish resistance in general, and specifically Irish-based nobility. The high spires are the Irish clergy, so these would be Anglicans, and the pillars of stone are Irish merchants. And so if you squish them too hard, these are the things that are going to lead resistance to the bad things that the British king was up to. And the idea that diamond is strong, sure, but breakable. You know, if you have a thin enough coating of it on the underside of the island and it hits even gently, lands on a tall pillar or spire, you're going to crack the bottom of the island, and that would stop it from working. Now, the last part of this chapter, the section that I've saved for the end, this was suppressed. This was suppressed for a really long time because it's even shocking that Swift wrote it. We know that he has resisted criticism of monarchs. You know, he'll criticize governments, but your neck is on the line a little bit if you, back in the day, criticized the monarchy, especially a specific monarch, and especially a specific monarch that was so unpleasant and not particularly well-liked. Now, if the coating on the bottom side of the floating island is the English Constitution, and lowering the boom on the people of Ireland would have led the bishops and the nobility and the merchants to resist, that would be people using their constitution to resist inappropriate authority being wielded over them. Now, popular resistance, even in a world of monarchy, has held in Swift's day some real threat to the king. Charles I was ousted, James II was ousted, and while George I was not popular, which we know, there was also the Pretender. If you've read the Outlander series, you know the whole mishigas behind James III, or he called himself James III, and the Tories liked him. So George's position in power was not the strongest ever. Now you'll hear the name of a town, Lindolino, which people usually think is Dublin, and he talks about combustible fuel, and he is very specifically talking about his own pamphleting, that yes, it is combustible, but it is also combustible and lights people on fire and gets them all riled up. So he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth on that one. Iron mineral would be magnetite. And when he talks about people being given their own conditions, this is going straight back to that whole coinage thing that he was so ticked off at Newton about. So he's still holding a grudge. So here we go with a repressed section of Gulliver's Travels.
About 3 years before my arrival among them, while the king was in his progress over his dominions, there happened an extraordinary accident which had like to have put a period to the fate of that monarchy, at least as it is now instituted. Lindolino, the second city in the kingdom, was the first His Majesty visited in his progress. 3 days after his departure, the inhabitants, who had often complained of great oppressions, shut the town gates, seized on the governor, and with incredible speed and labor erected 4 large towers, one at every corner of the city, which is an exact square, equal in height to a strong pointed rock that stands directly in the center of the city. Upon the top of each tower, as well as upon the rock, they fixed a great lodestone, and in case their design should fail, they had provided a vast quantity of the most combustible fuel, hoping to burst therewith the adamantine bottom of the island if the lodestone project should miscarry. It was 8 months before the king had perfect notice that the Lindolinians were in rebellion. He then commanded that the island should be wafted over the city. The people were unanimous and had laid in store of provisions, and a great river runs through the middle of the town. The king hovered over them several days to deprive them of the sun and the rain. He ordered many pack threads to be let down, yet not a person offered to send up petition, but instead thereof, very bold demands, the redress of all their grievances, great immunities, the choice of their own governor, and other like exorbitances. Upon which His Majesty commanded all the inhabitants of the island to cast great stones from the lower gallery into the town. But the citizens had provided against this mischief by conveying their persons and effects into the 4 towers and other strong buildings and vaults underground. The king, being now determined to reduce this proud people, ordered that the island should descend gently within 40 yards of the top of the towers and rock. This was accordingly done. But the officers employed in that work found the descent much speedier than usual, and by turning the lodestone could not without great difficulty keep it in a firm position, but found the island inclining to fall. They sent the king immediate intelligence of this astonishing event, and begged His Majesty's permission to raise the island higher. The king consented, a general council was called, and the officers of the lodestone ordered to attend. One of the oldest and expertest among them obtained leave to try an experiment. He took a strong line of 100 yards, and the island being raised over the town above the attracting power they had felt, he fastened a piece of adamant to the end of his line, which had in it a mixture of iron mineral of the same nature with that whereof the bottom or lower surface of the island is composed, and from the lower gallery let it down slowly towards the top of the towers. The adamant was not descended 4 yards before the officer felt it drawn so strongly downwards that he could hardly pull it back. He then threw down several small pieces of adamant and observed that they were all violently attracted by the top of the tower. The same experiment was made on the other 3 towers and on the rock with the same effect. This incident broke entirely the king's measures, and, to dwell no longer on other circumstances, he was forced to give the town their own conditions. I was assured by a great minister that if the island had descended so near the town as not to be able to rise itself, the citizens were determined to fix it forever, to kill the king and all his servants, and entirely change the government. By a fundamental law of this realm, neither the king nor either of his 2 elder sons are permitted to leave the island, nor the queen till she is past childbearing.
Now, that last little bit, the by a fundamental law of this realm, neither the king, that actually wasn't suppressed. That's the only line at the end of this, the whole section, that wasn't suppressed at for over 100 years after the publication. And that's because that actually was a law. George I and his wife and his kids, they weren't allowed to leave It's a little dangerous because you may not get back ever. Now, evidently, he did sneak over to Hanover once in a while, but people in England didn't like that very much. I think the word putz probably fits George I quite a bit. When in doubt, go to Yiddish, I think, is where I'm going with that. Now, I did say at the beginning that I was going to explain why you couldn't actually have a floating island the way that Swift describes it. And that is because when you get that resistance from two magnets, it's because you have two magnets. You know, when you're putting the two poles together and you can feel the magnets pushing against each other, but then you rotate one of them to the other end and suddenly they snap together? All right, that would mean, in order for this flying island to work, that the Earth was magnetized. Now, Asimov makes a point that, sure, something could probably happen at the poles, but not in general. Not here, not the way Swift describes it. Regardless, he spent an awful lot of time working out a plausible theory of how you could get a flying island to work like that. They'd shown up in literature before, but never with an explanation. Swift was just a rule breaker right, left, and center, whether it was with science or political commentary. Oh, I love this guy. For our subscribing supporters, there is a small chance in Hades that I will manage to get the next section of Chaucer out to you. I'm also trying to finish up the final draft on the second book of What Would Madame Defarge Knit, which has been causing nothing but consternation and rage on my part because technology will not comply with my wishes. However, I'm so close to done with the second part of Chaucer. My fingers are crossed. I will remain hopeful. Either way, you will have the next section of Cool for Cats pop up tomorrow, and the next section after that of Cool for Cats will pop up on the following Saturday. So you will still have your Cool for Cats coming at you. And gosh darn it, if it isn't just that Chaucer takes so long to research and record. But I'm getting there. I'm getting better at it. All right. And so that's it. That is our show for today. I am off to record the show for next Friday. But in the meantime, enjoy thinking about how prescient and full of foresight and brilliance and wit was the fabulous Jonathan Swift. All right. Have a great one. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.